Hello, my name is Michelle Yana-Chan, the Wandering Book Collector, and this is my podcast, Conversations with Writers Exploring What's Informed Their Books and Their Lives, around themes of movement, memory, sense of place, borders, identity, belonging, and home. In this edition, I'm joined by the writer Janann Brownell to discuss her book, Ghetto Classics, How a Youth Orchestra Changed a Nairobi Slum. Janann, welcome to the Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
You're a journalist by trade, Janann, and this book began as an article. What was it about this particular story, of all the stories you've covered, that made you want to expand this one into a book?
That's a great question. I think what I found very compelling was that, you know, sometimes as a journalist, and you know this as a journalist as well, that you go to a place and, you know, you've got to have this kind of journalistic kind of, you know, objective face on, and you sort of see these things and you try not to react. You don't act like, oh, that's completely normal to be seeing this or that. And arriving at the St. John Community Center, where the Ghetto Classics Orchestra practices and trains, and you stand up on the sort of bleachers in the amphitheater where they practice, and you look out over acres and acres and acres and acres of rubbish, because they're the ghetto or the slum where they're based is next to the largest garbage dump in all of Kenya and possibly all of East Africa. So these young people are tuning their violins and they're, you know, playing the clarinet as these toxic fumes from the dump, you know, waft across as they're playing. And it just, the juxtaposition to me was just very compelling. And to hear, you know, this wonderful music that was being played while, you know, you're seeing all of this horrible stuff that's happening behind in the dump, and also knowing there's so many, you know, terrible things that are also happening in the slum, that just, and I remember one last thing that really compelled me as we left that day, that first day I went there, there was this billboard and it said something like, you know, hope for, well, I can't remember the name of the church, hope for whatever loves babies. Please don't dump your baby in the dump. If you, you know, need help, please call us, because a lot of women will either take their live babies or their babies that have died and leave them in the dump. And it just, that to me was just really compelling.
Was it the music as much as the story? I mean, can you remember and describe the first time you heard the orchestra or some of the musicians play?
Well, what's been interesting is I spent about 6 years working on this, and looking back, they were not great when I first heard them play. I mean, they were okay, but it was kind of, you know, they were using used instruments, you know, a lot of them didn't know how to tune their instruments, you know, whatever. And so, I mean, it was okay, the music was fine, but, you know, now you hear them and they're, you know, sound like a professional orchestra. So that in itself, in hindsight, has been really interesting. So it wasn't that the music per se was just so fantastic. It was more the fact that, you know, it was all of these guys running around in like their flip-flops and their, you know, tank tops with violins, you know, sort of trying to play, you know, Pachelbel's Canon. And so, it wasn't the beauty of the music per se. Now it is. Now you hear them and you're like, wow, you guys have improved so much. But at the time it was a little bit rusty. Let's put it that way.
And did geography also not really matter? And you know, it's the story that kind of got you by the throat. Could it have really been anywhere? Or do you have a particular affinity to certain places like Kenya, and that's what drew you in?
I think that's exactly it. I think I've always had an affinity to East Africa, in particular, particularly Kenya. I think that it is one of my favorite places on the entire planet. And I think that I had been, before I started work on this book, I had been kind of toying around with doing a book about girls' education in sub-Saharan Africa. And so I knew I wanted to do something around, you know, what was happening across the continent with education and, you know, and how that, whatever that could look like. And so I think, and it just also gave me an excuse to be able to go to Kenya on many more occasions. And so I think that it was kind of all of those things. It was also, you know, I love to write about sort of international development. I'm interested in education. I'm very interested in sort of the role that arts can play in community development. So it kind of had all those things that I'm really interested in all in one story. And so it fit sort of the perfect prescription for me in terms of spending time writing a book on something like this.
And what is it about Kenya, Janann?
You know, I write this in the book, but I think it's very interesting. And I don't know if it's because of where Kenya is located geographically on the planet because it's sort of near the, you know, it's on part of it is on the equator. But there's something about the sky in Kenya that when you're, you know, on the Mara or you're in Tsavo or you're in Samburu and you look up at the sky and it's just, it goes on forever. And even when you're standing in the garbage dump in Dandora in Nairobi and you look up at the sky, it's still that really broad sky that goes on forever. And so I thought that that was very interesting to me that, you know, it's the same sky that you watch, you know, sort of the Great Migration on the Mara is the same sky of which this horrible garbage dump is based. And so I don't know, some that for me, it's the beauty of Kenya that even, you know, you're standing, you know, in, you know, feet of dirt and or sort of feet of garbage. And it's still this beauty that exists in that country that is heartbreaking and stunning. I don't know if that helps answer your question, but that's kind of what's always struck me about Kenya.
Unlike the stories that you report on for newspapers and for news magazines, your writing in the book is very involved and you leave your journalism at the door oftentimes. How did that feel as a departure from the day job?
Well, I wrote three different versions of the story, or sort of two and a half, let's say. I started it as third person, then I decided to do first person, then I went back to third person. And I sort of, there were some conversations that I had with people that I wasn't quite sure how to put in third person. So that was kind of difficult. But in the end, I felt it made more sense to kind of just tell it as a biography and try and, you know, be sort of, you know, an objective biographer of this orchestra. But one of the things that was very hard for me is that, you know, I spent 6 years working on it. And so over that time, I developed a number of relationships with young people in the orchestra and people sort of in that ecosystem around the orchestra who've become friends. And so sometimes that objectivity that you strive for as a journalist goes out the window because, you know, somebody tells you something that's very personal and you think to yourself, that would be a really good anecdote for my book. But also that's a really personal story of somebody that I care about. And I don't know if I really want to share that. So I kind of found that very difficult from time to time where I got, you know, people to really, really open up to me because I was friends with them, but also to kind of be able to know when there was a limit as what I felt I could kind of tell and share, because, you know, where does the sort of journalism, you know, begin and end? So that was sort of an interesting thing to kind of think through and work through when I was doing the book.
And has it been hard also to return to, you know, objective, neutral reporting after this, or are you finding it easy to switch back and forth?
I think it's really easy to switch back and forth. I think also because, you know, when I'm writing an article that's, you know, 1500 word piece about, you know, I don't know, an art gallery or something, you know, there's not that kind of relationship. There's not that kind of, you know, kindred spirit feeling necessarily that you do in one interview that's a half an hour long. But, you know, it's these long relationships you have with some people, you know, that is that big shift. So no, I didn't have any issue kind of coming back and sort of, you know, putting that journalistic hat back on.
And for the original piece that you wrote for the New York Times, the news story that was probably 1500 words long, is there anything you really wish that you could have included, space permitting, or that you really feel like it wasn't complete because you didn't know it at the time and you hadn't spent another 6 years looking into the story?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, I found it very difficult story to write in that I did what I do very often is I overreported. So I had way too much stuff. But I feel like I covered pretty much everything I felt like I could cover in that piece. I mean, I think looking back and reading it, maybe some of the descriptions I gave were a little bit simplistic that I wouldn't have necessarily, you know, described certain people in a certain way. But then again, that's because I got to know them over the years. So, but I think for the most part, yeah, for the amount of space that I was given, I probably did the best that I could with all of the notes that I had and, you know, my complete over-reporting of it.
The foreword to the book is by Elizabeth Njoroge, and she's the founder of the orchestra. And she agreed to your writing of the book because you were an outsider to not only the community, but Kenya as a whole. What do you think she believed you had that, say, a Kenyan writer might not have had?
Well, she and I had a lot of conversations around this because I'll be honest, when we were trying to get the book published, one of the big critiques that we kept getting from my agent was that, you know, I was a white American writing about an orchestra in a slum in Nairobi. And so we, Elizabeth and I, talked it over, and I said, well, I think it probably would make sense to have you write the foreword, just because I think it gives a little bit more credence. But also I think, you know, you can kind of set, you know, set the stage as to why you thought, you know, me of all people was qualified to do this. And I think, you know, we live in a time in journalism where oftentimes in general, but especially in journalism, where, you know, there's this whole idea of, you know, oh, you should only write, you know, what, you know, if you come from that particular area, only you could be qualified to write that, which I don't agree with. I mean, I think, you know, journalists who come from a particular area, let's say Ukraine, for example, they have, you know, a certain understanding that people who are not from that area, you know, don't have. But then there's also, again, the sort of subjectivity that you have from being from a place. And I think that, you know, in a place like Kenya, where there's a lot of the ethnic communities have sort of some tension sometimes. And so I think that, you know, if you'd been from a particular ethnic community and you'd written, you know, about Ghetto Classics, which also has, you know, it's a multi-ethnic, you know, orchestra, you know, maybe you would have some underlying sort of feelings about something that would sort of maybe underplay in the book, not on purpose, but because, so I don't know. I mean, I think, I feel like I came in as an outsider. I learned a lot. I mean, I learned, you know, about sort of making sure that I was being as honest as I could be to the people that were involved in the orchestra without losing my sense of perspective, I hope. But it's, you know, I think it would have been a different book if somebody from Kenya had written it. And I'm not saying it could have been better or worse. I just think it would be a different book and how they kind of viewed a lot of the things that, you know, from my outsider's perspective, I kind of maybe glommed onto.
Does it feel vampiric time to time in the reporting, particularly for this story? I mean, I know I have this time to time too, but you're dropping in, covering the story. There was much more investment for you in this one, but, you know, then you're on to the next thing.
You do. I mean, I call, at least journalistically wise, I call it like a brain dump, right? You know, like I spend, you know, like 2 weeks working on a story or 3 weeks or whatever, and I know everything there is about a story. In fact, I just was talking to somebody about a story I'd written 4 or 5 years ago. And I'd spent 6 months working on it. It was a science story. And I knew everything about this. I mean, I was like an expert in it was a story about this thing called swimmer's itch. I was an expert. And I literally the other day couldn't tell you the name of the parasite that I'd written about. I could not remember it. So I think there's brain dumps that happen, you know, and you're just kind of like, you're really focused and then you're like, boof, move on to something else. And that was also what was interesting working on this book is that I'm so used to constantly, you know, getting bored of something after 2 or 3 weeks. But, you know, for 6 years, I'd never worked on anything in my life for 6 years and I still didn't bore of it, you know, and I thought, well, that says something because it must have been what I was supposed to write on because usually I just kind of, you know, I'm done. Once I'm done with it, I'm done with it. And I was not, I mean, I am kind of done with it now. Like I'm still involved with the orchestra, but like I did bore of it.
It's not a perfect love story and anything but, which of course is what makes it all the more interesting, that there's deception and there's jealousy and there's kind of jockeying for power and influence. Did that happen in real time as you were writing it over those half dozen years? Or did you think it might be a bit of a fairy tale rather than a warts and all kind of tell all?
Well, I mean, again, one of the things that I found really tricky, which I don't know if this is going to answer your question directly, but I mean, is that it was a really hard thing to fact check a lot of stuff because you're only, there's no, you know, archive, right? There's no, you know, asking Elizabeth for dates, you know, she'd be like, I think that was before my daughter was born, but I'm not sure, you know, that kind of thing. Or stories where, for example, one of the characters in my book, not characters, she's a real person, but one of the people, Emily, had told me about her sister who had been kidnapped and gang raped for a number of days. And then once she'd been let go, she found out she was pregnant. She had a baby and then she ended up dying of AIDS. Now, I can't verify any of that, right? I can't verify that her sister died of AIDS. I can't verify that her sister was gang raped. You know, I have no way of sort of fact checking that. So you kind of have to go on what people tell you. And I think I tried to write it so that I would say, this is what I was told, you know, as opposed to being able to go back and, you know, go to the Nairobi Bureau of, you know, death certificates or whatever, and be like, oh yes, her sister did die of AIDS, you know, so that was kind of tricky. So you kind of have to, and again, I think that's where the relationship building was important because, you know, I would say to some of these people, now, did it really happen the way you said it did? And then sometimes they'd kind of go back and be like, well, you know, so it was tricky in that sense to not be able to verify stuff and to try and write it so that I wasn't necessarily saying that person wasn't telling me the truth, but I was sort of saying, but take this with a grain of salt.
I wondered though if when you got there, you felt like, oh, this is like a kind of rags to riches tale that I'm going to be writing. Or did you already kind of envision this was going to be as complex as it turned out to be with you know, all these challenges that the orchestra ended up facing, and it wasn't just a kind of a happy story?
Yeah, I think I definitely went in with, you know, this idea of like, oh, isn't this just a wonderful fairy tale story? And as I kind of got more and more involved and sort of seeing, you know, that there's so much, you know, the layers that, you know, were peeled back. And also, you know, I got in the end quite critical of sort of how the orchestra is run as well. And sort of, I hope that I put that in the conclusion too. And so I think that that's something that was really important that, yeah, I didn't want it. I wanted it to be what it was. And I mean, in other words, I wanted to tell the truth. I did think it was going to be more fairy tale, and it wasn't, because there were definitely things where I'd see infighting, or I'd see, you know, this person is saying this. And so, yeah, it was much more complex, I think it turned out to be, than I sort of probably had originally envisioned it to be.
And there's a passage in the book focusing on some individuals who, as you put it, were tired of ghetto classics being presented as some kind of sob story all the time. And I quote this, you said, you know, they felt like audiences gawped in amazement at their accomplishments, kind of for you know, for the fact they're an orchestra that comes from a slum. And you quote one of the older members of the group, Emily, who you've just mentioned, and she said this: "Yes, we've come from hard lives in Coracoche, but constantly being used for our slum roots now feels insincere somehow." I was taken, Janan, by your response to that in the book, because you wrote this about Emily, and I quote you: "She happily reaped the advantages of being in a slum orchestra when it suited them, but they also hated that they were being treated and defined in a special way because of where they were from." It struck me as quite harsh. I mean, don't we all do that in some capacity? But I feel like you must feel that quite strongly.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw that a lot, where, you know, on one, and you're right. I mean, we're all hypocrites, right? We're all hypocrites. We all, you know, take advantage of the things we need to and throw it aside. But I think that there were definitely moments where, you know, a lot of them would complain to me about things. There's a character, Brian Keffer, and Keffer sort of was always, you know, he was the one who kind of put some doubts in my mind in a positive way about things. You know, the fact that he felt like, you know, on one hand, you know, we're supposed to be out there, you know, representing the orchestra and being this really, you know, sad sob story. But if we move on from it, then we're sort of like, are we constantly supposed to be like, but we came from this? Like, when are we just individuals? Why does it have to be, why does our background have to play into, you know, how our successes are? And I think, yeah, I probably was a bit harsh, but I felt like it was also important to sort of show that, you know, like I said, Emily, God bless her, but, you know, she definitely had moments where she, and they all, and many, many of them all sort of, they complained about it, but then they were like, oh, we can play for Obama. Yeah, we're on board. So, but again, we're all hypocrites. And so I think that I was just sort of maybe pointing that about myself as well in some ways, maybe.
The strap line to the book, Janan, is how a youth orchestra changed a Nairobi slum. Did it?
Yeah. I think it has. I think it's, I mean, has it completely, you know, 180 degrees changed it? No, but I think that there are aspects of the neighborhood, the overall, the neighborhoods, I should say, it's a couple of different slums where the different students come from. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, first of all, it's from a big picture perspective, I think that there's a lot of pride that people in the communities whose, you know, sons and daughters and nieces and nephews and whatever are in the orchestra, you know, to see, you know, their children, you know, playing in front of Pope Francis, or to perform in front of Barack Obama, or to have, you know, the former president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta's wife, you know, come to the orchestra and see them perform. There's a sense of community pride that, you know, this is where we're from, but yet look at our young people, what they're doing. But also, I think that it created, in many ways, people in the orchestra became community activists. There's a young man in the book, for example, called Stephen Ayoro. He kind of was very much involved in, there's the main dump, and then there was like an illegal dump that was sort of connected sort of via a river. Anyway, and they wanted to get that dump closed. And it took them years and years, because there's all of these politics, you know, Nairobi politics is, you know, no pun intended, very dirty. And so you had politicians who wanted to keep the dump open because they got a lot of money from it. Anyway, so they went out on a limb, you know, the people in the community, to try and get this closed because they knew that there were people whose, you know, big pockets were getting filled by dumping all the garbage. So they started, you know, helped restart a campaign. During COVID, for example, you know, they started a food drive for people within the community. A couple of the young women in the orchestra, Tracy Akinney, who I talk about a lot in the book, she and some other young women decided to start visiting older women within the community every week to make sure that they were doing okay. So I think that because they'd been empowered about being in this orchestra and feeling like their voices made a difference, and that they, you know, they were sort of, you know, this sense of belonging and the sense of, you know, that they were doing something, they were being given credit for things that maybe they'd never been given credit for before, if that makes sense. That kind of empowered them and it gave them a sense of agency. And I think they did help change their community. And I think a lot of the young people who are in the orchestra have gone on to do degrees either in Kenya or abroad. And that's also kind of helped change and shape the community as well. So yeah, I think, is the entire community changed because of it? No, but there have been, you know, changes within the community that I think have been quite huge.
And that's something that's sustainable. Like, you feel like it's quite systemic rather than just individuals that, you know, got lucky and happened to be in the right time at the right place. But it's something much more intrinsic that you think will continue.
I mean, I'd like to think so. I mean, it's been around for 15 years, the orchestra. And so I'd like to think that, you know, there's like, so Simon Ndungu, who's was the manager of the orchestra and now is here in the UK doing a second master's degree. You know, he sort of said to me that, you know, when they first started out, he was in the first cohort. And he said, when they first started out, you know, and dignitaries or guests would come to visit. And it's, Korogocho is a very rough, you know, slum. It's, you know, they call it the slum of slums because they get the garbage from all the other slums. I mean, it is a rough community. You know, they would, you know, there would be lots of problems. They'd have to kind of, you know, ensure that, you know, people weren't getting, you know, robbed or attacked when they came to visit. And now people know that when they're sort of, you know, not even dignitaries, but visitors, to leave them alone. You know, there's that change of, you know, oh, okay, we see, you know, white people, we see like Muzungu coming in, you know, we're not going to do anything to them because we know they're probably going to see our friends at Ghetto Classic. So I think there's that. I don't know if that really answers, but I think there's, you know, who knows, maybe some of those changes will, you know, stop, or they'll sort of end where they naturally will end. But some of those things I think have changed, I think maybe forever.
Did it make you think differently about social programs such as this one, kind of in a more macro international way?
I mean, I think yes, for sure, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, I years ago interviewed a woman called Molly Melching, who started an NGO in Senegal. And she said, you know, one of the things that's really important is we have to understand that it's not us bringing knowledge to these communities. It's the community sharing their knowledge with us and us working together to help them figure out the best way to shape things. And I think that a lot of, you know, that's the sort of new sort of thought process, international development these days, is like helping empower communities because they already have the knowledge and they already have lots of the capacity, but they just sort of sometimes need that boost up. But I also think that, you know, there has to be medium to long-term planning. And I think one of the problems with Ghetto Classics has always been, and again, I say this in the book, you know, Elizabeth kind of started it, you know, with, you know, she had no idea what it was going to turn into. And therefore, sometimes I think it's gotten a bit lost. Is it a social program with a music component or a music program with a social component? And I think it's really important that, you know, organizations know, you know, you don't come into a community, have a lot of money, do something and then leave. You know, what's the long term? How are you going to make it sustainable? And so I think that I learned a lot about sort of international development work on this book. I learned a lot about what kind of can work and what can't work and how sometimes things that look really great on the ground in a bird's eye view, they're not as good as they could be, but how do you make them better and how do you help support that to make it better?
You've chosen for your first book a story that meant a lot to you and you wrote it very personally. Is this where you want your writing to go?
That's a good question. I mean, I think my second book that I've written, well, I'm in the process of writing, is a very personal story that's intermixed with, you know, lots of research. But I think after this second book comes out, completely different, not at all related to, you know, international development and music, I think I might just go back to the sort of journalistic side, because I feel sometimes it's very raw to write about yourself. And sometimes it feels a little bit sort of narcissistic. And there are moments when I'm like, why would anyone care about this? So I feel like, yeah, I don't know if I, yeah, I think I might be done after the second book of being sort of first person-y about how I write.
Tell us about this next book.
So this next book is called, so far working title, How I Became Your Mother, A Global Surrogacy Journey. And it's about my children were born through surrogacy in the US. And so the book is, it's a personal story because it obviously details, you know, sort of the experiences that I went through as somebody who's gone through and survived infertility. But it's also looking at surrogacy across the globe and sort of looking at all the sort of different aspects of surrogacy. You know, who is a surrogate? You know, why do people work with surrogates? You know, how do children born through surrogacy feel about it? What are the debates and ethical questions around surrogacy? And so it's a passion of mine, very much a passion of mine, to the point where working on this book, I met a woman who started a grassroots advocacy group in my home state of Michigan. And I've since become a board member, and the two of us pretty much have, we're helping to change the law in my home state. We're actually, in the next couple of weeks, our bill has passed through the House, the Michigan House, and it's going to go into the Senate in a couple of weeks. I'll be going back to Michigan to testify. And yeah, so it's much more of a personal story about my life versus an experience that I had visiting a place that I didn't have any real connection to aside from loving it as a place to visit.
And finally, Janan, as someone from Michigan, as you say, but living in London for a big stretch of your life and on the road a lot with work, where feels most like home?
Where feels most like home is we have a summer house on Lake Michigan where I grew up and where my great grandparents bought it over 100 years ago. And for me, that is home. My brothers and I play these games sometimes, like silly little games. And my brother one time said, okay, here's the game. Either you have to spend the rest of your life, you know, at the cottage in the sort of area where the cottage is, or you can never go back to the cottage, but you can go anywhere else in the world you want to go. What would you do? And I didn't hesitate. I said, I just stay at the cottage. And my brother said, really? You know, that means you couldn't go back to Kenya. You couldn't go back to, you know, Bali. You couldn't go back to, you know, Peru. And I said, yeah, there's no argument there. It would be Northern Michigan. So yeah, that's where I feel most at home.
Is that where you're going to end up?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was just talking to a friend who happens to run like the local cemetery, and she was like, you need to get your plot, because like everybody's like, they're going quick. So like this summer, I mean, it seems weird, but you know, I feel like I need to kind of go like plot out. Yeah. I mean, I think I'll literally, my remains shall end up in Benzie County, Michigan for the rest of my days, or not my days. My days will be over, but for the rest of the world.
Wow. That is actually not quite the question I asked you. I was kind of just like, where might you spend like time later in life? I didn't actually mean, where are you going to be going?
Where was I going to spend in eternity? Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, I'll stay in London and yeah, end up probably eventually in Michigan.
I look forward to seeing your wanderings and your movements. Janan Brunel, thank you very much for joining me on The Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And to my listeners, if you like the podcast, please take a moment to rate us on the app you use to tune in. We want our guests to be read more and heard more, and strong ratings help make that happen. Thank you. Till next time.